Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The past few months have seen a growing storm of harassment online, and women are the primary targets. Media critic Anita Sarkeesian was driven out of her home by harassment, targeting her for her work analyzing the treatment of women in video games. And then game designer Zoe Quinn was also forced to leave her home after abusers posted her home address and phone number online. And just a couple of days ago, programming educator and game designer Kathy Sierra removed her online presence after 10 months of harassment. And when we talk about harassment, it can mean rape and death threats, cyber mob attacks, malicious impersonation, and videos used for extortion or shaming. While free speech does not protect most of this activity, many perpetrators never face any consequences. When faced with online abuse, many just suggest ignoring the attacks. They'll just go away. Others suggest that having tough skin is a prerequisite to engaging with others online. But it's becoming very clear that online harassment has real-world effects on the people experiencing the harassment, from psychological trauma to undermining careers, credibility, and confidence. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about who should be responsible for preventing online harassment, and how should the legal system and social media companies respond to digital threats. We reached out to Twitter and Facebook. Twitter did not respond to our requests for interviews. Facebook provided us with links to its community guidelines. But we are joined today by Professor Danielle Citrin, professor of law at the University of Maryland and author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. It's a book that focuses on practical, lawful ways to prevent and punish online harassment. Hi, Danielle. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Danilo Campos. Danilo is a freelance mobile interaction designer and developer, and he's been writing about this issue for the last few years. And Danilo joins me in studio. Hi, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me today.
Nice to have you. So, Danilo, I want to start off with you. Do you think people understand how pervasive this issue is, because it's getting a lot more attention now? A lot of the women are actually writing about their experiences. But do you think people realize just how pervasive this is?
I think it's a deeply misunderstood problem, or at least underestimated. I think we don't realize so often when I talk about online harassment, the response is, yeah, that's a really tough case. That sounds horrible. But what is it, two or three people a year? And my answer is that, you know, the Bureau of Justice Statistics has shown that it's estimated that over 850,000 people experience some form of cyber stalking a year.
Wow.
And they define it as sort of persistent online expression targeted at someone that causes substantial emotional distress and often the fear of physical harm. And so I think we do underestimate the problem. And it's really until recently that brave individuals are coming forward to tell their story, even though there is the fear that if they talk about it, much as Kathy Sierra did in 2007, that there will be a subsequent wave of attack just for speaking out. But I think increasingly we're coming to understand the problem, especially the media has done, I think, a terrific job of telling people stories in a way that really explores the depth of people's suffering.
Danilo, you've been writing about this for a few years. One of your good friends has been harassed. How pervasive is this issue?
So I think it's not well understood that not only this happens, but this has a real impact on people's lives. You know, my colleagues who are men who write about any of this stuff, say, on Twitter, will often report that they have no troubles that come as a result of this. You know, someone in my position who can speak from a male perspective often gets lauded for speaking up, whereas a woman who says the same kind of stuff is going to see some real viciousness in her mentions almost immediately oftentimes. So I think there's a lack of understanding of just how deep this can go and just how deep the impact can be.
Have you received any harassment as a result of writing about this issue?
So a handful of times some folks will show up in my mentions in response to, you know, the quote-unquote Gamergate scandal recently. Anytime you mention something around that, some children will show up in your mentions to say something nasty to you. But, you know, for me, it's something that's pretty easily handled by a block button, and there's just not that many of them to come and bother me.
What about you, Danielle? Have you been harassed for speaking out about this from a legal perspective?
A little bit, right? So some anonymous emails suggesting that people are going to rape me But really, nothing like the ways in which, you know, the victims I've talked to and interviewed for my book experience it. You know, that it's not just for the victims, you know, anonymous threats, but persistent anonymous threats that are graphic, that include people's home addresses, that are then also posted and shared online, and people are impersonated in posts with their all of their contact information and the suggestion they're interested in rape, and lies spread about them, like accusations that they have sexually transmitted diseases, that they're prostitutes, their nude photos exposed. So nothing, you know, and it's often a perfect storm of threats, privacy invasions, defamatory lies, and even technological attacks, you know, so that the effort is to silence people with technology, like distributed denial-of-service attacks. So I've experienced nothing, you know, in the way that the folks who I've interviewed for my book have.
You know, I have to say it's amazing that you say that you have been threatened with rape, but that is nothing like the women that you are working with and that you've interviewed.
Right. I'm sure, and that's not to trivialize how I felt about it at the time.
Right.
Right.
But it just speaks to this issue. I mean, I can't even imagine, you know, getting messages like that.
Right.
But so tell us, I mean, you've laid out a lot of examples, but tell us a little bit more, be a little specific, because I just want to make sure that we're clear here about the seriousness of this issue.
Right. And I'd like to go and return to Anita Sarkeesian for a second, just to really have people understand what she's been grappling with for 2 years. And then I'm going to talk about a kind of more ordinary person, you know, like the everyday person who faces this kind of abuse. So 2 years ago, when Anita made an announcement that she was going to raise funds on Kickstarter to explore sexism in video games, sort of like the wrath of a cyber mob followed. And it was threats of rape, not only on her Twitter feed, but graphic threats she received anonymously. Some included doctored photographs of her looking like she was being raped. And a game appeared immediately called Beat Up Anita Sarkeesian. And so any key that you touch on your computer, her face would become increasingly, like, bloodied and purple. And it wasn't just, of course, to terrify her, but that was clearly the effort. Kickstarter received false reports that her fundraising effort was a fraud. And Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook received false, again, abuse reports suggesting that her pages, which were part of her work, right, that they were hate speech, spam, and terrorism. I mean, this is all in the effort to silence her and to stop her from doing what she does, which is to work and to write about media criticism. And her website, Feminist Frequency, was hit with distributed denial of service attacks for months on end. So it would go up and go down because it would be, you know, overrun by traffic that would shut it down. And in the last 2 weeks, she received graphic threats, both on email and in her Twitter feed, that included her home address. And the message was, bitch, watch your back, you're next. So I guess I hope that, you know, we say it's just threats, but unless we understand the fullness of this experience, it's unrelenting over a two-year period of time, I don't think we can really get it, right? So, I mean, so Anita's very well known, but it's, for all of the individuals I talked to for my book, the better part of the folks I talked to, it was over 60 people, were just the everyday person, the dentist, the nurse, the stay-at-home parent, the PhD student, right? So Holly Jacobs was getting her PhD in industrial psychology, and she had a relationship with someone for 3 years, and they shared together, you know, intimate photographs with one another. And after they broke up, she started receiving emails from strangers that said they demanding sex from her or saying they were interested in sex from her and then linking to posts that she had never seen before. So she Googled her name, and what she found was over 300 posts on revenge porn sites and porn sites.
Wow.
That included the nude photographs, all of her contact information, including her work web address, so that included her work address, her cell phone number, her email address, and some of the posts impersonated her as if she was writing and advertising for sex, anonymous sex. Other posts spread lies about her and said that she was sleeping with her students. You know, she was a PhD student, so she was teaching just in the course of getting her PhD. And her school received phone calls, like without someone naming who it was, accusing her of sleeping with her students, and her part-time employer received, like directly via email, the nude photos. So she changed her name. She said to me, like, how am I supposed to get a job after my PhD is done? Mm. Right? How am I supposed to get a date if the first 10 pages of a Google search of my name are a completely destroyed and devastated, sexually humiliated, you know, person? She had to assume a new identity. And I just have to say, every time I got an email, and I continue to this day, the story is always the same, and it's depressing. Mm.
So I'd like to amplify what Danielle said about the technological impacts of some of this stuff, because these forces are harnessing computers to do some pretty nasty stuff. In the case of Adria Richards, she was working as a developer evangelist for a Colorado-based company called SendGrid. And at a conference called PyCon, Adria reported some fairly sexist behavior that was going on behind her. She did this publicly. This was behavior in violation of the conference's posted code of conduct, so it was known to be unacceptable. And the vicious response that Adria received from this included all of the stuff that everyone has talked about here. But more than that, there was a distributed denial of service attack leveled on her employer. And SendGrid, to their eternal shame, completely rolled over for these folks and fired Adria because they wanted their website to come back online. They wanted their business to be, you know, restored to normal. And so this incredible act of cowardice was, you know, a result of the online bullying that this person was receiving.
So a denial of service attack mm-hmm. results in chaos mm-hmm. for the company that's targeted.
That's right.
Just to let people know who aren't familiar with that term. Well, I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, offline, you think of a harasser as a single person. And so when we're talking about the women who are harassed online, it just sounds like, how is it that 300 searches come up with a face superimposed on porn or her own body? So can you also talk about that, how often it's not just one person?
Oh, yeah. And Kathy Sierra, who you mentioned earlier, recently published a fairly lengthy essay explaining her experience and, you know, kind of giving the download on everything about how this harassment works. And she makes a very important point about how services like Twitter can amplify hate in minutes instead of weeks, which may have been the older order of things. And so what can happen, and Anita Sarkeesian has also said this, you see a very quick buildup of hatred and misinformation. And once these, you know, a small number of trolls can build up a huge wave of people just by spreading a little bit of misinformation that pushes the right buttons for the particular passionate constituencies that they know how to manipulate. And so you can go from two people with a grudge to thousands in the course of an afternoon.
That is Danilo Campos. He's a freelance mobile interaction designer and developer, and he's been writing about online harassment for the past few years. Professor Danielle Citrin is a professor of law at the University of Maryland and author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. It's a book that focuses on practical, lawful ways to prevent and punish online harassment, and that's the topic of today's show. We're talking about who should be held responsible for preventing online harassment. How should the legal system and social media companies respond to these threats? We did reach out to Twitter and Facebook. Twitter did not respond to our requests. Facebook emailed us back and provided a link to its community guidelines, and we'll talk about that in just a couple minutes. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on online harassment? If you don't know much about it, because a lot of people don't know how pervasive it is, but over the past few months, a number of women have shut down their online accounts. Some have even left their homes because of threats. We're talking about rape threats, photos of women being strangled, defamatory lies, posting their address, their kids' photos, their social security numbers online. If you have any questions about how this works, we'd love to hear from you. If you have experienced online harassment, what was the experience like? How did you deal with it? And then also, how do you think these companies should deal with this? If you work for a social media company, how is your company dealing with it? How should it? The toll-free number is You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately, we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m.
feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Danielle, you compare online harassment to workplace harassment back in the 70s. Women couldn't just up and leave their jobs to avoid the harassment, the same way that it's incredibly difficult for people to just sort of walk away from social media.
That's right. And just in the same way that we dismissed and minimized sexual harassment in the workplace in the late 60s and 70s, it is the exact same responses that we see today. It's almost like a really bad flashback, you know, so that when individuals speak out about their story, like just as when Kathy Sierra, who's featured in my book, spoke out against her abuse, when it initially happened, the response at the time was, Daily Kos founder said publicly, look, if you can't handle the heat in your email inbox, then just get out of, then just leave. And we said the same to women, right? If you can't handle being sort of flattered in the workplace with sexual, requests by your bosses, you should just get another job. And that's obviously not an option for people. Kathy did, in fact, shut down her blog. It was incredibly successful for 3 years. But what she gave up is writing and speaking about what she loves most, which is programming. And she has not come back really in a sustained way since. So the ways in which we sort of blame victims is the same, right? So Holly Jacobs has been told it's your fault. You shared your nude photos with your ex. Shame on you. Just as we said to women, that pretty dress you wore, that was your fault in the workplace. You sort of asked for it. And we once said of workplace harassment that, look, the workplace has its own norms. It's its own rules. And we say the same about cyberspace. It's some sort of Wild West where anything goes. But of course it's not the Wild West. It's where we all are, right?
Right.
And network technologies are where we're all using them. So I think the analogy helps us understand society's refusal to really see and deal with online harassment. But it also, I think, points to a way forward. Just as law stepped in and helped us understand sexual harassment in the workplace as sex discrimination, as a true social problem, law can do the same today.
Well, talk a little bit about the law. When does this kind of harassment become illegal?
Right. I mean, so there are laws on the books that criminalize harassment, stalking, and threats. So when you have sort of repeated or persistent course of conduct that includes privacy invasions like the posting of nude photos, defamatory lies, true threats, it crosses the line from protected, what we might say, annoying, offensive, totally protected speech into unprotected speech. And there are laws in many states that can ably address this, but law enforcement just doesn't get the technology and doesn't get the law and just tells victims to turn their computers off. The law is imperfect, so there's important avenues of reform. In some states, harassment and stalking laws are limited to direct communications with victims. And so in a case from New York, a man recently, his indictment was dismissed because he sent the nude photos of an ex to her employer and to all of her contacts in her email sort of inbox, but he never sent them to her. And so it didn't, it wasn't covered by aggravated harassment laws in New York. So we've got to fix those laws, update them to capture the full, the full breadth of the abuse. Today it's Twitter, tomorrow it's robots and drones. And I think we should consider, just as California has, criminalizing revenge porn. The posting of nude photos without someone's consent and in violation of their sexual privacy.
Wow. It also seems like, Danila, maybe you can speak to this, it seems like law enforcement needs a lot of educating on this, because in several stories about online harassment, you have a case where a woman would call the cops and the cop would show up and say, what's Twitter? Just shut it down. They just don't understand how it works.
Educating law enforcement is going to be a very long process.
Yeah.
And I think one of the issues right now that's very challenging is that documenting these cases can be, almost impossible. You have folks who will be making these nasty tweets show up. They'll send them, they'll delete them a few hours later. And so, you know, the ephemerality of the platform, which can be very beneficial to some groups under some circumstances, can also be leveraged for some very nefarious ends. And the platform vendors are asleep on the job here, I think oftentimes because their leadership is not including any sort of folks who are part of the underrepresented groups who are disproportionately receiving this sort of harassment.
Hmm. Well, we've got a few callers on the line, so let's take a few before we go to break. Let's hear from Jessica in Hayward. Hi, Jessica. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just wanted to thank the guests for their work, but also bring up something that, to my knowledge, going on in the teen and tween community, and that is a platform that you can get online or on your phone called Ask FM. And it's based in Latvia, and a lot of teens and tweens are on it, and they don't know what it means. They don't know that, you know, there is no legal recourse with a social media platform that's based in another country. It permits anonymous posting unless the individual blocks it. A lot of teens and tweens are using it without parental knowledge, so they don't know how to use privacy settings. And then this is becoming a poisonous playground for young people. It can be girls against girls, just extending the middle school dramas and the high school dramas to the online platform, the social media platform. And they're teaching each other it's innocuous. So when girls rush in to support each other, oh, don't listen to that person, they're a coward, they also say, haters gonna hate, delete the post, move on.
Wow.
You're making too much out of this. So here, you know, your guests are raising awareness, talking about vigilance, talking about methods of solving the problem, but if we're not careful, you know, the next generation is inoculating themselves to the online abuse.
So Ask FM, I didn't know about this, just looked it up. It says we already have more than 120 million members in 150 countries. Teenage years are often a voyage of self-discovery. We make the journey easier by giving our members the option of anonymity. It fosters uninhibited, truthful conversations and encourages opinions and builds self-confidence. Are you, either of you, familiar with this?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Danielle.
I'm sure Danielle is, too.
Yeah.
You know, it is like many sites. Formspring before it, a site in which anonymity can both, of course, be such a force for great things, but also a force multiplier for really bringing out the worst in us. Mm-hmm. So it's true that Ask FM has led to teen attempted suicides, you know, the kind of abuse that we've seen with adults, but for kids, mm-hmm. they're so emotionally vulnerable. That it becomes something that drives them to suicide, right? Not that it wouldn't for a grown-up, but it's, you know, there have been documented cases of kids committing suicide and attempting suicide because they have sort of been tortured on Ask FM. I imagine Danielle knows Ask FM well, too.
The interesting thing from this is the discussion around anonymity. And anonymity on the internet is very powerful for folks who might not want their identities discussed as they figure out those identities. Maybe they have parents who might be hostile to them, and especially in the teen years, that can be powerful. The issue that we see right now is that I think it's important for anonymity to be a privilege. But if we want anonymity to be a privilege, there are technological things we're going to need to solve because it's very, very easy for somebody to just start a new burner account after they have thrown away another.
Mm. All right. Well, we'll talk about some of the technological solutions after the break. And also, because Jessica is a parent, I'm sure a lot of parents are listening thinking, what do I need to do to protect my child? And so I'm sure you both have thought about this. It's probably not your area of expertise, but I think we do need to address that after the break. So thank you for calling in, Jessica. Today we are talking about online harassment and abuse with Danielle Citrin, professor of law at the University of Maryland and author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. Danilo Campos is a freelance mobile interaction designer and developer, and he's been writing about this issue for the last few years. What questions do you have about online harassment? Have you experienced it? And then how do you think corporations should respond to this? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Your Call from the best of 2014. So we're not taking calls right now. As 2014 winds to a close, please consider a donation to KALW. Peter Grzyzowska of Kenwood and M. Thompson of Pleasanton have done so. You can do the same. Click on the Donate Now tab at kalw.org. And Happy New Year from all of us here at your local public radio station, KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea, a guest idea, or a story you'd like us to talk about tomorrow, you can email it to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about online harassment and abuse. Over the past few months, a number of women have either gone offline altogether or have been driven out of their homes because of online harassment. We're talking about rape threats, photos of women being strangled, defamatory lies, their addresses, kids' photos, social security numbers being posted online. We're talking about how this should be dealt with, who should be responsible, and how should media companies respond to digital threats. Again, we did reach out to Twitter and Facebook. Twitter did not respond to our requests. Facebook provided us a link to its community guidelines. We'd love to hear from you. If you work for a social media company, how is your company dealing with this? How should it? And if you've dealt with online harassment, what was your experience like? The toll-free number is 866. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately, we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m. to hear about them. Today we're joined by Danilo Campos, freelance mobile interaction designer and developer. He's been writing about online harassment for the last few years. Danielle Citrin is professor of law at the University of Maryland and author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. She profiles a number of women who've been harassed online and then focuses on practical, lawful ways to prevent and punish online harassment. Before we go to our next caller and guest, I wanted to ask you both about, you know, how parents should deal with this. Danilo, do you have any tips for parents who are concerned?
Honestly, all I can say to this is I am so glad that when I was coming up as a teenager, I did not have to deal with any of this.
I feel the same way.
Because the nice thing about that was that when school was unpleasant, you could leave school.
Yeah.
And you could have a break from it. And the issue that we see now with a lot of these online communities is, as Danielle was saying, you have these extensions of high school drama to make this now a 24/7 issue. Mm. So I am mostly sitting here in abject horror at the thought of being a parent in the 21st century. There's a lot of great things that have come with it, but the complexities terrify me.
So different. Danielle, what are your thoughts on this?
So I address parents and schools in my book, and I think the key, and I have teenage daughters, so I feel like I'm a sort of living experiment in my own household, but I think for parents, the key is to get involved, get engaged, talk to your kids as early and often about how to be a respectful digital citizen, and it's a conversation that you have to have in with really tough examples, and then obviously all the time. Training never works, right, or conversations don't work if it's a lecture and then it stops, it's one and done. You've got to talk to your kids as often as you can, and sometimes about really hard examples, like the Steubenville rape, you know, that example of the young girl who was raped at a party, passed out, and her photo of her being dragged by the football players was tweeted to thousands of people. And I think we got to talk to our kids about the act of retweeting, right, is being engaged in the cyber mob, right? It may not be tortious, it may not be criminal, but it's something we've got to teach kids about, you know, the kind of humiliation and great, you know, suffering that, or emotional suffering that people suffer, you know, was caused. And ways in which we talk to our kids about being responsible, and parents often plug out. They say, like, oh, the technology is too much for them. And they say, kids, they know more than I do about technology, but you can't say that as a parent. Part of your responsibility is being involved.
For parents who might not know much about how the technology works, do you have a resource for people to go to?
You know, Emily Bazelon wrote a terrific book called Sticks and Stones, and I think it helps us understand the ways in which parents should talk to their kids about bullying. And, you know, MTV, the Fine Line, there are a lot of online resources like Family Safety Online Institute. So there are a number of resources that I can maybe provide to you later, and you can put them online if you'd like, that parents can go to think about ways in which they can talk to their kids, but also help them understand and appreciate the technology.
All right. Well, thank you for that, and we will put those links on our website. Let's go to our next caller. Valerie in San Francisco is founder of, I believe it's the ADA Initiative, which is a nonprofit that seeks to increase women's participation in the free culture movement. Hi, Valerie. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
So I understand you have some positive solutions to deal with harassment.
Yes, I really like that people are phrasing it that way, because when we first introduced them, they talked about was how negative they were. Our organization's first major project was to create the example anti-harassment conference, or example anti-harassment policies for conferences, which are in person, and that was very successful. It just laid out what seemed like obvious rules of conduct, but clearly were not, like don't show pornography in your slides, and just put it in an easy format that people could copy and reuse. And then we wrote a bunch of resources on how to actually implement it. It's made a huge difference. It's been adopted by literally thousands of conferences in the open technology and culture space, as well as science and many other areas. And now what we're moving on to is applying these codes of conduct online, using these same principles of creating a governing policy that has very specific examples about what's not permitted, and then enforcing it, including kicking people off your online community when they violate it. There's several organizations that we're working with, big names and small, to do this, and there's a list of the organizations that have these online codes of conduct on what is called the Geek Feminism Wiki. If you search for that in Google, you will get a list.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for calling, and we will link to your website. Danila, what do you think about these strategies?
You know, I have been calling for... there's a startup accelerator called Y Combinator. They are kind of the premier player in their space. Everyone respects them a great deal. And since 2007, Y Combinator has had an online community called Hacker News. Hacker News is a place that is not necessarily the most friendly to folks who are outside of the in-group of, you know, kind of younger, upper-class white males that dominate Silicon Valley. And so what you'll see on Hacker News is very negative conversations at times for folks who are outside of that group. It can be a very hostile place. It can be a very unpleasant place. And I've been calling all year for Hacker News to have a code of conduct. I've been calling on Y Combinator to take responsibility for the very toxic community that they have created there. So far, they have not acted on these calls, but I think that a code of conduct that very clearly specifies what people should be able to say, what should be acceptable or not in their community, would go a long way to making this space more welcoming to more folks.
What is the responsibility of social media sites like Twitter and Facebook? I mean, what sort of effect can they have on this? And again, Twitter did not respond to our request, but Facebook sent us a link to its community guidelines. What could they do?
It's my position that these people have a duty to make their communities more inclusive because, in Y Combinator's case, we're talking about a company that is now worth over $30 billion.
Wow.
And they have been, they've gotten to that valuation in part on the strength of the online community they created in Hacker News. Hacker News gives them this ability to be front and center in front of all of these technologists who Y Combinator would love to have as founders. It gives them the opportunity to get their job postings for their portfolio companies in front of thousands of technologists every single day. So these assets that the companies create have tremendous value, but they also have negative externalities that these companies are responsible for remedying. They have the opportunity to make changes here. There are technological strategies that they could pursue. There are social and community design strategies that they could pursue, and they are not pursuing them because I think in part all of us who are participants in, you know, Twitter or Hacker News, any of these communities, have been complicit in not speaking up, not demanding better, not just for ourselves, but for the folks who are different from us, who don't necessarily have as easy a time when they're not having an easy conversation.
And in the case of Twitter, you wrote a blog post outlining five basic things Twitter could do to curb harassment, including basic things like blocking someone who uses any word the user decides. What other small fixes could Twitter make? And have you been in touch with Twitter about this? I mean, are they talking about this?
So Twitter never had anything in particular to say in response to that essay. To the EFF's fantastic credit, they took a lot of those suggestions and started a project to make some of this stuff work. I believe it's called Block Together. But you know, in Twitter's case, there are so many very easy fixes. There's technological stuff that, you know, could be a Rolls Royce of complexity in terms of, you know, let's use some sentiment detection algorithms and figure things out. And all of those would be very nice. But right now, people don't need a Rolls Royce. A bicycle would suffice. So one of the things that would be very straightforward to implement right now is say, hey, if somebody has a account that is less than, you know, this many hours or this many days old, I don't want to see their mentions, period.
Hmm.
And what that would do is instantly take away one of the great powers that harassers have right now, which is to create a big army of burner accounts that they can create and throw away after they have been blocked. So giving users that limited amount of control over their experience is something that is fairly trivial from a technological perspective. More than that, I want to address preemptively what a lot of folks get worked up about when these conversations happen. This is not about censorship. This is not about saying that the platform as a whole is going to keep down this voice or that voice. This is about giving individual users some agency, some choices, some discretion over what kinds of communications they choose to receive. And if we can't all get together and say that that should be a basic right as somebody who uses these platforms, I don't know what else to do with this conversation.
Danielle, have you been in touch with any Twitter executives about this?
So I am part of an anti-cyber hate working group that works directly with folks at Twitter and Facebook and other large intermediaries. And so I think we're beginning an important conversation that I was even 2 years ago, Twitter would say, we're a speech platform. We don't censor anything. And now I think are more open. Maybe it's, you know, in part because of the high-profile sort of threats, both in the UK and the United States, that they're coming around at least to having conversations. So I think they're increasingly open to thinking about ways in which victims can protect themselves, but they have a pretty strike-oriented approach to the idea that they should be manicuring their site. And I think one thing that we really need to put on the table is the reason why hosts can just ignore defamation and threats and privacy invasions on their sites is because there is this thing called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which completely immunizes them from liability for the user-generated content. Even though this was, it was passed as part of a pro-censorship bill, it was called the Decency Act.
Right, right.
So
I remember that.
Let's just say, put that aside, right? Its whole purpose was to block pornography or have Good Samaritans block pornography to protect children. That was the point of the statute. But much of it was struck down. What remained was Section 230. And what is troubling is that even the worst actors, you know, sites that whose whole business model is destruction, like revenge porn site operators, they shamelessly brag that they cannot be found liable unless they're engaged in the game of extortion, because they say, look, it's not, we're not shaming individuals, other people are. And even though they solicit illegal content, they claim an immunity to liability, which I think it shouldn't be. So that's why, you know, having these efforts of talking to intermediaries who are so close to the abuse, like the Twitters and the Facebooks, working with them is so incredibly important.
Do you think because the issue of online harassment and abuse is getting so much attention and because it's so real, I mean, again, women are leaving their homes because of real threats, do you think that there are signs of real change, Danilo?
I don't think it's my place to say, because this isn't an issue that impacts me nearly as deeply as it does others. So I can't tell you.
Danielle, what do you think?
I mean, we've come a long way, certainly, since 2007 when I started writing about it. You know, when I first talked about and published a number of law review articles about online harassment as a sort of civil rights problem, the response was, oh, you serious? You know, like, stop making a mountain out of a molehill. This is juvenile antics. Like, turn your computer off. Stop being, like, your bitty-witty sensibilities. You know, give me a break. To now, you know, especially in the last 18 months with the phenomenon of non-consensual pornography, I think lawmakers are paying attention. Intermediaries are paying attention. I'm at least slightly hopeful. I'm usually a very Pollyannish person, so I'll admit that. But, you know, I'm feeling a little hopeful that this is a moment in which we are, it's coming into our consciousness.
Well, and the other thing is how, even if these laws are passed, how are they enforced? So California Governor Jerry Brown just signed a bill that will make it a misdemeanor to distribute nude or explicit photos or videos of someone without their consent, even if the person was the one who took the photo.
Right.
So, but how do you enforce something like that? I mean, what if my, you know, a boyfriend sends a nude photo to my employer? I mean, how do you enforce that?
Right. So, I mean, law enforcement could enforce that rule. What's tough about the new California bill is it requires the intent to inflict emotional distress. It's not, strictly speaking, an invasion of sexual privacy statute, so that even if the poster sort of knows he's betraying someone's or her trust, they have to intend to inflict emotional distress, and that can be difficult for prosecutors. So often we see, like, these statutes are on the books, but are they enforced? We see the under-enforcement of law in part because I think law enforcement needs better training, and as Danilo says, that's hard to do, and that's a long road. But even if we train officers, some of these laws aren't well-crafted, and we could improve them.
Danielle Citrin is professor of law at the University of Maryland and author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. Her book profiles women who have been harassed online and abused online. It also focuses on practical, lawful ways to prevent and punish online harassment. Danilo Campos is a freelance mobile interaction designer and developer, and he's been writing about these issues for the last few years. He also has friends who've been harassed online. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any experiences you want to share or solutions. How do you think Facebook and Twitter, for example, could deal with this pervasive issue? You can give us a call at 86. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We have a comment from a listener on our website who writes, through social problems, all the companies seek problems in order to improve their products. So why should they do anything about this? They have insurance and are free from any liability. In order to be empowered by their products, they seek to be considered as judges and executioners within their high-tech community. It's all about control, right? So this listener says they've got no reason to deal with this because they don't have to.
Let's talk about the real reason here, which is this comes down to dignity and to economic equity. Danielle touched on a really important point earlier, which is that these spaces represent a 21st century commons. And so if you're going to create a community space, if you're going to create a platform for people to have conversations, there is a responsibility that exists there from a simple perspective of the golden rule that you need to design and construct these communities in a way that can be inclusive. And if you aren't, there is an economic breach that can come from that. I have so many benefits that have come from being able to actively participate on Twitter that have come to me career-wise. I would say that half to two-thirds of my great career breaks have come from my ability to participate in these online spaces. I have friendships that have come from knowing people through these online spaces. And so if we're all going to sit back and say, oh, well, it's completely acceptable for people to use this technology as they will, and we're going to look the other way as terrible breaches happen to people's dignity, there is a complicity in denying people economic stability that I don't think anyone can feel comfortable with.
Are any companies marketing safe spaces to women, people of color, and marginalized communities? Are they marketing themselves as a place where you can come and maybe not be harassed? Has that happened yet? Don't know of any. Danielle, do you?
You know, I think there are some communities that, you know, embrace moderation that have powerful kind of norms of their sites, whether it's Jezebel and Feminist to others. But, I mean, I think the largest platforms, the best that we have is something like Facebook that has clear community guidelines and at least efforts to ban harassment and hate speech, which they define very narrowly. But nonetheless, like attempts at least to create user norms like Mozilla. I mean, there are other spaces in which companies are trying, but they're, you know, it's sort of always incomplete because of their scale and also because I think they could always do a better job and be more transparent.
And also because of their management. Like, let's be real about a place like Jezebel. Jezebel is a place that has women who are writers, who are editors, who are running that publication. But Jezebel's corporate minders, Gawker, were completely asleep on the job as Jezebel's editors had to deal with a deluge of graphic violence images that were showing up in their comments. And it got so bad that Jezebel had to publish an essay on behalf of their entire staff saying, Gawker, this is unacceptable. We need help. This needs to be better. This should not be part of our jobs to deal with this level of graphic imagery. So a big problem right now is that the people who are signing the checks, the people who are making the decisions, have been completely tone-deaf, insensitive, or worse to these situations.
Yeah, and actually the listener who commented online says the same thing, that this is all about profit and that companies just don't have to deal with this, and maybe unless they're forced to. Let's hear from another caller. Let's go to Chris in San Francisco. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Rose. This is a timely show. I am in the middle of leaving Facebook because of some problems that I had there. And while I was having those problems, I definitely did have some ideas about some things that Facebook was missing. I was harassed several years ago via Craigslist when I was trying to buy some Burning Man tickets. Somebody took my information, which was my work phone number and my cell phone number, and placed an ad in the, I don't even know what they're called, the random people who want to have sex ads.
Casual encounters.
You know, put an ad in. I was suddenly inundated. My phone was ringing. I had 7 lines on my phone. They were all ringing. My personal cell phone line was ringing, and I had coworkers that were running around trying to get in touch with the phone company to delist my personal home number. I had people that were calling Craigslist to try and pull the ad at the time. There was no sort of real fast, easy way for me to shut it down. There were just, you know, it's really not that easy to get in touch with somebody at Craigslist and get kind of quick action on something like that. So that was definitely an eye-opening experience for me. I am on Facebook, and I moderate a large community there, and I have been engaged in the last couple of days in some conversations that are quite heated, some social justice issues that people don't see eye to eye on, and I started getting some comments from somebody on a page that was a public page. It was a protest page that had been set up, and that's why it was made public. And I realized there was no way for me to block a person on Facebook via a public page. So when things started to get heated, I realized I had no recourse. I also realized that my profile was, unbeknownst to me, more public than I thought it was. And it seemed that despite my having changed my settings to be entirely private, you know, only visible to friends, lo and behold, it was actually set to public when I went to look. And what this did for me is it made me question continuing. It made me question, you know, how much farther I wanted to go with having any sort of public stance on any kind of social justice issue, how much I wanted to have my name and my identity out there linked to these types of things that are heated and things that people feel very strongly about. And the reality is, you know, I didn't hear the whole show. I tuned in late. So I don't know if there were people specifically talking about the inherent sexism in all of this. I feel like people were sort of holding back and wanting to say that this seems to be something that is happening equally to men and women when we know it is most definitely not. When I get upset with somebody online, I don't think about threatening them. I don't think about digging through their public profile to find information that I could use against them in some way. And I do think that men feel much more entitled to do this type of thing to women online. And they have a lot more power. And I definitely think that communities like Facebook and Twitter need to realize that there is a monetary situation in this for them, as opposed to the last caller or the web comment. You know, when I decided to leave Facebook, I am abandoning a community of people that is 1,000 members strong. And there's a monetary gain in having that community there for Facebook. Mm. And so if I leave it and it goes away, Facebook absolutely does lose potential to generate revenue.
Well, Chris, so. Thank you. Thank you so much for calling and sharing your story. I just realized we're almost out of time. Danielle, we have a couple emails similar to Chris, basically saying that these solutions are just a Band-Aid for the real issue of sexism. So that's obviously a big issue. Do you want to just address that quickly because we're almost out of time?
Right, sure. I know it's true that 70% of online harassment victims are female, and when men are attacked, it's sort of the same playbook, which is it's sexually threatening and sexually humiliating. So it's very gendered, the abuse. And I think that's right. It is a societal problem. So much of this is changing hearts and minds. And we can use the power of pocketbooks. So one sort of note we can end on, I think, is that Soraya Chamali and Jacqueline Friedman led a campaign against Facebook to pressure them to take down pro-rape pages, and they got 15 advertisers to say, we're going to withdraw our advertising, and Facebook changed its policies, and now there's a task force that Soraya and Jacqueline are part of that are in constant conversation with entities like Facebook. So I think there's certainly possibilities for when we get enough people together and mounting dissatisfaction, if you get advertisers involved, it may indeed work.
Danilo, 30 seconds.
I just want to take a moment to completely validate what Chris said on the phone. Let's make absolutely clear that this is about misogyny so often. This is about hate against women, and it's very specific. It's very cruel. And I want to call upon my male colleagues, my male technologist colleagues, to say this is a problem, and I hope that you will look at it closely.
Anita Sarkeesian recently spoke about her experience and said one of the most radical things you can do is to actually believe women when they talk about their experiences. Danilo Campos, freelance mobile interaction designer, and Danielle Citrin, professor of law at the University of Maryland and author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
What makes an effective corporate pressure campaign? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about how people power can make big companies change their ways. Walgreens recently bowed to public pressure to remain in the United States after considering moving overseas. And Oxfam successfully pushed General Mills to cut greenhouse gas emissions. What tactics work? How have emergence of social media and the sheer size of multinationals changed what it takes to win? Join the conversation on Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.